Right, did you know? Well, I'll tell you about that in a moment. A landmark study has found women with chronic fatigue, or ME, tend to have more symptoms and co-occurring conditions than men. 17,000 people took part in a world study of the syndrome led by experts from the University of Edinburgh. Karen Quinn joins us to discuss ME as a person suffering from it. Good morning, Karen. How are you keeping at the moment?
Hi, Craig. I'm okay, thank you.
All right, okay. So how do you describe, before we talk about your experience, we've heard it described as chronic fatigue and the medical name ME. How do you describe it?
I just don't see, people hear the name chronic fatigue syndrome and they just see it as tiredness, but there are so many other symptoms that goes along with that. So it's very debilitating disease.
And leaves you open for the worst effects of other things as well, presumably. You know, that if you catch something else, it's amplified by your ME.
Oh, definitely. You're very, your immune system is very low. So if you would get the flu or a cold, you get really ill with it again. Your ME symptoms just flare up as well. So it can, like, leave you very open to other things as well.
And for the most part, it's one of those conditions that's invisible. So to all intents and purposes, Karen, if someone saw you, they might jump to another conclusion or whatever it might be, which, as well as everything else, makes it very isolating. It's a hidden condition for the most part, I think, other than those that are close to you and those that know you, Karen.
Definitely. Even when I was really ill, people would say to me, but you look well. You look all right. Even though I just was so ill. And because you look okay, because people can't see there's anything wrong, that's really hard to take as well. Because in fact, people are saying, well, you look okay, so you must be okay. Yeah. You don't look ill. So I found that very hard.
Take us back, because this is a condition that has taken so much from you and taken so much of the life you should have been able to enjoy ordinarily. You were just 21, training as a nurse in London. At that point, were you free of it, or when were you diagnosed? So take us through from that age, Karen.
Well, it was Christmas 1989. I got gastric flu and I was ill for 2 weeks. I got better from that and I carried on doing my nursing. But I kept getting things wrong with me. But I just put it to the side. I didn't think anything about it. I just got married. I had everything going for me, a career that I always wanted. And it was March 1991 that I started, that we thought at that time I was getting the flu. And the doctor said, you're getting the flu. And then after that, my health just started deteriorating every day, every week. I kept going back to the doctors and, oh, you know, you've got the flu. But over in less than a month to 2 months, I was getting this awful feeling in my legs, just above my knees. I started unable to walk. They were getting numb. They were getting heavy. And I couldn't explain this. I was starting getting problems with my hands as well. I started getting like a fog brain. My glands were getting swollen. I was getting stomach problems. Mm-hmm. Again, we didn't know what it was then, but it just overpassed.
And Karen, speaking about this condition on numerous occasions and similar conditions, you get treated for absolutely everything except the thing that it is often. Were you lucky, or was that your experience that it was this, it was that, it was everything but ME? And when did you actually get a diagnosis or a GP or a specialist sit down and say you've got chronic fatigue?
Well, I was very lucky with the GP at the time, and she said, I think you've got something from post-viral fatigue from the gastric flu. Then I was referred to the London Hospital, and lucky enough, there was a specialist at the time, and he was specialising in ME, chronic fatigue, which was rare at that particular time because we were just hearing it was yuppie flu, etc. Now, he took me into hospital for over a month, and he done every test. Every test was coming back negative, 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 which I found frustrating because I just wanted something to be positive because I felt so ill. But after all the tests and that, that's when he diagnosed me with ME, chronic fatigue syndrome.
And Karen, can you? Is there anything in the body that can diagnose it, or is it a case that you eliminate absolutely everything else and that's what you're left with? In other words, is there a blood test or a, you know, a tangible diagnosis for ME?
No, not yet. And that's the frustrating feeling, is that there is no test there yet. So it's just getting rid of everything else when it all comes back negative. And then they would diagnose that you've got ME, chronic fatigue. Now, it can affect everybody quite differently. Mm. My case, I couldn't walk at all, and I was bedbound for 10 years. Some people may not have it that severe. So it's really different for every person. So that makes it, again, quite difficult. Also, I got mine from gastric flu, but you can get it from other illnesses as well.
Mm-hmm. So this is not something necessarily that's hereditary or that you're prone to. It's an infection, and how the path of that infection and how it interacts with your body can trigger this. So in other words, any of us potentially, or albeit rare but not fully uncommon, could end up with ME.
Definitely. It's not hereditary. But yeah, I was healthy. I was young. I had everything to live for. And it was just whatever happens to your body with the gastric flu. There's still not 100% of knowing exactly what he's caused it. But hopefully in time they will.
And does it have any, I mean, obviously bedbound for 10 years in a wheelchair, still to this day you've got mobility issues and you'd have to pick and choose presumably how you use the energy that you have. But in terms of damage to vital organs, your heart, your brain, your kidneys, your liver, does it have any progressive, does it have any progressive impact on your general health?
A general health with the organs, no. It doesn't, but it does leave you a lot with brain fog, memory trouble, and things like that, but not in any vital organs. I haven't known it to affect mine.
Now, you have created a Facebook page. It's called Donegal Support for ME. Why did you decide to launch that page?
Obviously, moving to Donegal as well, I don't feel there's any support in Donegal. I went on then not so long ago to train to be a counsellor to help people like myself, because I feel having ME, my life just changed drastically. And I just do not think there's enough support in Donegal. There's support for other areas of illnesses such as MS, motor neurons, etc. But I don't feel there's a lot of support to do with ME, chronic fatigue syndrome. So I'd like to help others and get a little community going to know that you're not alone with this illness.
And I think that's really valuable because I'm not sure what your case is, and I'm not asking you either. It is one of those conditions that even those around you and as loving and as supportive as they are probably don't fully get it like someone else who has it might.
Exactly. I don't think with anything you don't know until you actually have the certain thing, whatever it's about. So definitely, I think if you've got someone that else has got ME, they'll understand you a lot more.
Your life is difficult, but it was worse in terms of rehabilitation, treatment. What can be done, or what worked for you, Karen?
Well, medication came from America, so I was given injections, and that slowly actually got me out of being a bed and being fully in a wheelchair full term. So, and like watching what you do, how you pace yourself, You know, if you know you're going to do a certain thing one day, you have to make sure the next few days you've got nothing planned. So it's really about trial and error, but also, but if you've got some support group going, you know, you could get understand from other people how it works for them as well. But you see, if I was going to go out for the day, I would have to go back into the wheelchair because I can't physically walk for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then with ME as well, sometimes you can do things for one day and you manage to do it. A day or so later, you pay the price for it. Yeah. So you have to be quite aware of that as well.
And your hopes and perhaps sense of progress can be dashed, I can imagine. All right, Karen. The Facebook page is Donegal Support for ME. It's about connecting people, supports and information and what have you. It's in its infancy, but hopefully, you know, I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who are affected by this that can join. I wish you the best of health that is possible for you, Karen, in your situation. And I really appreciate you joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Take care.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. That's Karen Quinn, who has chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME. And you can go to Facebook, search Donegal Support for ME. As Karen described it there, it can be very isolating. It can be invisible to those who don't know you. So maybe in joining with others who can relate and understand, it might bring some comfort on your journey. The man who brought you The Murder of Michael Collins, Paddy Cullivan, historical entertainer, brings you the incredible story of the mysterious death of Theobald Wolfetone, the founding father of Irish republicanism. Good morning to you, Paddy Cullivan. How are you keeping?
Good morning, Greg. Great to see you again. How are you doing?
You too. I'm doing good. Your work is obviously, it's in terms of entertaining and getting bums in seats and what have you, but it is triggering something of a conversation people are somewhat reluctant to have, I think. You know, how accurate is our history and our understanding of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose this all started in, you know, 2016 when I noticed when we were doing the centenary stuff, there was a lot of ahistorical BS, to quote Dermot Ferreter. I don't want to, on a morning show, say the actual words, but it seemed to me that our history had been handed to us very much by, let's say, government sources, official history sources, establishment sources. And there were just a lot of doubtful things in our history, especially as, you know, if you look back at the newspapers of even Collins' time or Wolfetone, they're all government controlled. They're all very much propagandizing for the time and getting the story of what happened to Wolfetone out. And the more I look back at the original sources, which is what I did, the more I saw this whole construct, this whole story of the death of Wolfetone has been just put together. And I really wanted to get back to the actual story, the meat and potatoes, and see what exactly had happened. And it's a fascinating tale. And I, you know, it has annoyed a few Trinity historians who've written into the newspapers and stuff like that. But, you know, I have to say that I found that some of them have been wanting in terms of their estimation of what actually happened to Tone.
Yeah, and maybe their acceptance to gobble up the narrative rather than perhaps challenging it or questioning it. So talk to us a little bit about the principal character of this latest work of yours then. Wolfetone, I mean, briefly, can you tell us what the accepted version of his demise is? And then maybe that'll lead us into where you go with the story.
Well, I start my show in Donegal, as you must, Greg, as you well know. Wolfetone, you know, had been this amazing character. He had been a barrister who started writing pamphlets that became bestsellers, basically to free Ireland, to unite Protestant, Catholic and dissenter, and try and free us of the tyranny of the British Empire, George III, the monarchies, emulating the American Revolution and the French Revolution. But of course, he was a reasonable guy. He'd left the country when the United Irishmen were banned, went to America, wasn't going to get any help there, went to France, and they said, yes, we will help you. So in 1796, he comes over on a mission with 15,000 French troops. Unfortunately, the weather is bad in Bantry Bay, and there's other nefarious reasons why they didn't land. But that scared the Irish government so much that they dragooned Ulster and they, you know, terrible tortures of the local people, which led to the outbreak of the 1798 rebellion. So while Tone is in Paris again, he's there saying, look, we've got to help these people. They only have pikes against guns. And the French agree, and they send three missions. The first one lands with Humbert in Killala, an incredible story that lasts 2 weeks. Napertandi lands in Rutland Island in Donegal, would you believe, stays there for a week, but realizes the French have been defeated at Ballinamuck and turns back. And then Tone himself sets off, and the Battle of Tory Island takes place. It's the last major battle of 1798 in which he takes part. 3,000 troops on about 9 ships are trying to land in Lough Swilly. Unfortunately, there's a the Royal Navy are not going to let them pass. They intercept them. And there's a 4-hour naval battle in which Wolfe Tone fights bravely as if courting death with the ultimate coolness, said Bompard, the commander. But they are stopped. They are captured. And he's brought to Derry. Now, people debate whether he's brought to Letterkenny or lands in Lough Swilly or Buncrana. But in any way, the story starts in Donegal. He's captured. He's brought to Dublin, put on trial, sentenced to die on Monday, the 12th of November, 1798, by hanging. There's a controversial court case. His lawyer is fighting to say, look, his trial was illegal, blah, blah, blah. Lord Kilwarden says, you're right, it was illegal because it was a court-martial, even though Tone was a French officer. And so they send a messenger up to the prison to fetch him. The first time they're rejected, the second time the messenger sent up, it comes back. Tone tried to take his life last night in jail. He can't be moved. The wound is too bad. Tone lasts another 8 days, no visitors allowed, and then dies on the 19th of November, supposedly from the self-inflicted wound. That's the official story. I've dug deeper.
Right. So instantly, does it seem unlikely to you that that would be the type of act, with everything that went through, that Wolfe Tone, you know, it's unlikely, is it, in the first instance, that he would choose to go out that way?
Many historians believe it, because they, you know, Tone had written of, you know, the bravery of William Jackson, people he'd known who'd done the same thing. But, you know, I've looked through every letter. There's a fantastic series of books that came out, and I studied it during COVID. I went day by day through Tone's last 8 days or 9 days. He's fighting for his life. You can see it. He dresses up as a French adjutant general for his trial to say, look, I'm a Frenchman. He writes to Matilda, his wife in Paris, saying, I'm as tranquil as I've ever been, and you will have no cause to blush for me. His lawyers are working on his behalf. He knows this. And yet, when it comes time for the execution, he somehow cheats death. And a lot of Republicans like this story. They think that Tone has had agency in all of this. But I see something much more nefarious as having happened. And I think it's to do with the idea that he might have gotten away, and that there was a cabal of law enforcement and military in Dublin who, contrary to Lord Cornwallis, who had taken over the whole thing, the whole running of the 98 rebellion, they want to make sure Tone doesn't get out alive or have any chance of getting out alive. And I've gone through it day by day, news report by news report. The supposed weapon used, the razors or whatever, has never shown up at auction or anything like this, even though his jailer, William Sandys, was a major collector of stuff, including Tone's, not only Tone's death mask, but Robert Emmett's death mask. All these guys used to collect all this stuff. You know, famously, the French flag that was brought aboard in Derry was sent by George Hill down to Edward Cook, the head of Dublin Castle, for his collection of French curiosities. You know, so these guys, there's a lot of stuff missing in the story. They make up an awful lot of stuff. There's supposed letters he wrote in prison, even though he was in a straitjacket. The letters are fakes. I got them out of the National Library. They're not even in his own hand. So there's something weird going on. But then there's a drama playing out afterwards where William Sandys, his jailer, wants to make sure that Tone is buried in a graveyard. So, you know, you can't, if you've inflicted a wound on yourself, you cannot be buried in consecrated ground. And yet he is in Bowdenstown, and the direct orders of Lord Cornwallis. So there's a fight going on between these kind of loggerheads, the police force of Dublin and the main man, about what to do with Tone.
But so if the consensus was on trial, I'm sure you'd be confident that you would present enough evidence to at least question I don't know where I'm going with that, if you know what I mean. But do you feel that you have researched and developed enough to sort of say, right, we really actually need to? Of course, we'll talk about your show and how you present it, but there's enough here to actually say we really need to look at the narrative that's been accepted.
Well, as the great Donegal historian Tommy Graham, who runs History Ireland, has said, the best you can say about Tone is that he died of a cut throat, but whether it was his own doing or someone else's, you know, and that's the question we need to ask. And you see, I find, Greg, with all of this, you know, a lot of historians come out to me and say, oh, you have no source for that. And you know, that's a leap or that's a stretch or, you know, maybe the letters were dictated. What I say to them is, look, if someone's covering something up, they're not going to leave all the evidence lying around. So you have to fill in the blanks. And secondly, you can say, okay, yeah, maybe the letters were dictated. Maybe the razor was left in the cell by his brother. Maybe this and maybe that. Individually, yes, I'd agree with you. But for all of those coincidences to take place with the same thing happening, and not to compare the man to the man, but it's very like the Jeffrey Epstein case. It's very strange that all these things happen. The cameras don't work. The guards fall asleep. You know, all of this stuff. And it's very much the same situation. You're kind of going, lads, I could take one or two coincidences, yeah, but I'm not going to take 20.
Right. So, you know? I mean, one of our most popular items in this program is a history slot. So we know the people of the Northwest are fascinated with history. There's such a strong Donegal connection, Derry connection to this as well. So I think, you know, you'll fill the baller if you just sat at a table, you know, and presented your case. But for those who haven't seen your show, it's much more than that, Paddy. So if you can just describe people's experience they can enjoy in the Bala Theatre, Bala Buffet, this coming Thursday, 8 p.m.
Well, as everyone knows, I have a home in Gorda Hork, so I opened the show with a movie, you know, where that I took facing out to Tory Island and saying, can you believe that the last great naval battle of the 18th century took place off the coast of Donegal? And it's true. Medals have been cast about it and all of that. But then I go into the story and it does, you know, there's 300 images. There's a lot of comedy involved because Tone was a humorous man, and I try and make the thing entertaining for people as well. And I kind of go into the background of what was the Protestant ascendancy like? What was Ireland like? The life that he grew up in. But then I also have a few songs. I have a beautiful song in that moment, They Were Free, you know, about him, but also a song dedicated to this kind of academic historian that kind of tries to see both sides of the story. You see, Tone wasn't just murdered once. As far as I'm concerned, he was murdered twice, because the academics who accept this story, they're part of the conspiracy against him, as far as I could see. And it's, you know, it played into the hands of the Catholic Church. It played into the hands of a lot of people that Tone was weak in the end and all of this. And a lot of historians say, but, you know, his father had a big funeral and the rest. But no, it's for posterity. And it's for posterity I'm trying to defend these people's reputations, Michael Collins and Wolfe Tone. You know, Michael Collins was not a drunk fool who'd never handled a gun in his life or been in a firefight. Of course he was in Moore Street. Same with Tone. You know, somehow there's a willingness by our establishments to want to besmirch these people. And all I'm saying is, guys, there's more sides of the story. I'm not saying what definitively happened, because I can't prove it.
I think, though, there's a reluctance, though. You don't want to unravel your lecturers, maybe the papers that you've written, the books that you may have written, if it's all based on this source material that you're questioning. I'm not saying that's the motivation, but I'm sure that's all in there as well.
Well, here's what I say. I mean, there's a lot of very definitive sources in it. The problem is, here's what I'm saying, Greg. We all have the same sources, but sometimes you can draw a different conclusion. And of course, you got to put human nature in there and all the rest of it. And it's very important that we have a very romantic, idealized view of things, or a kind of a resigned view of things. And we shouldn't. And of course, with Tone, you know, and then the show is a game of two halves. It's got songs, it's got story. Imagine kind of a kind of your favorite podcast, but you're on stage and you're actually out hanging out with human beings, Greg. That's the best part of going to the Ballard Theatre. You're actually hanging out with human beings, which Tone would have loved too. But it tells you the wonderful story of the United Irishmen too, and their wonderful unifying message. You know, and one of the things I say near the end is, you know, if Tone woke up today and somebody said to him, you know, that Ireland's partitioned, and Tone would go, oh my God, really? Well, that's desperate. And how did it work out? And they go, well, the Protestants got the 6 counties in the north and the Catholics in the main got the 26 in the south. And the way the world was in the 18th century, Tone would have turned around and said, oh, well, at least my Protestant friends got the Republic of the 6 counties they wanted. How are the poor loyalist Catholics doing down south? Because the world was turned upside down. You know, the United Irishmen were a bunch of Protestants and Presbyterians. These were men looking for change and enlightenment. And there was many loyal Catholics who fought against them. So Tone turns everything on its head, and his unifying message is still the one we really need to take on board for the future as well, for the future United Ireland we might have, you know?
All right, that's the voice of Paddy Cullivan bringing you the incredible story of the mysterious death of Theobald Wolfe Tone, the founding father of Irish republicanism. It's an audio-visual spectacular featuring, as you heard from Paddy, hundreds of images, shocking new research and incredible songs, and it's not going too far to say that Paddy's daring to unravel the secrets and lies around what happened that fateful week in the Provost prison in November 1798. The Bala Theatre, Bala Buffet, Thursday night, 8 p.m. It's going to be a cracker, Paddy. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Paddy Cullivan there. All right, welcome back to the 9 till noon show. We're into the last half hour. Still plenty to come, including Kieran O'Donnell with the latest business news. He's back after his fortnight break. And also, we'll look forward to the Business Matters podcast. Right, some of your comments coming in so far this morning. Huawei phones are the best for cameras. Do you think so? Okay, I used to have a Huawei. No more. I was on a beach a couple of years ago and I love, well, actually phone, see the cameras are quite misleading. Samsung's last phone, do you remember the whole advert whereby it was pushed on social media where you could zoom into the moon and the camera was so good that you could see the surface of the moon and the craters and the coloration, and as it turned out, it was really artificial intelligence. If you shone it at anything white and it thought it were the moon, it would present you with this crystal clear image of the moon. So you can't believe anything anymore. I was on a beach a couple of years ago on a lovely summer's day. Two young girls had a small dog with them and another gentleman was across them with a big dog. Lo and behold, didn't the big dog kill the small one? The two teenagers were traumatised. I'll never forget it. Owners don't have control over their dogs. You never know how they might react. Put them on a lead. I would no more than probably never fully trust a human. I certainly would never fully trust a dog, especially around children. A caller says all dogs should be on leads, no exception. That lady dead on. Some dog owners don't understand the fear some people have. Mobile Shaw walk over, run with all types, overrun with all types of dogs running free. Please let your listeners know that there's a scam caller phoning saying he's from Bank of Ireland and someone has lodged into your account in England and transferred €18,000 to a payee, and the bank has flagged this as fraud. It gives a double number to phone and a case number to change your login details. Phone the bank and report. Wowzers. Okay, that's a dirty one. Be careful of that. And do you know what they know? We're talking about money laundering at the moment. These scammers are right across everything. So we're talking about money laundering, money mules, money going into your account or you taking money. And what do the scammers start doing? They pretend to be a bank saying that money's been lodged into your account. It's a dirty trick. Took a trip up to Dobeg Beach at the Fanad Arch. Problem was not just dog waste, but also fresh human excrement on the shore. Also, with the amount of household waste and litter scattered around, perhaps certain two-legged creatures should be on a leash or banned from our beaches. Oh my god. Was it definitely humans? That's disgusting. All right, okay. Stay right where you are, please, because we have our next guest in studio with us.
Business Matters, in association with ATU Donegal Faculty of Business. Now is the time to realise your potential by enrolling on the part-time degree in business. Only 3 years with one evening per week on campus and another online. Open up your future by contacting the faculty office on 918-6206 or visit lyit.ie today.
All right, Kieran, welcome back to the 9 till noon show.
Good morning, Greg. How are you keeping? I'm good, how are you?
How was your couple of weeks off?
Aye, good, aye. Didn't do a lot, just took it nice and handy.
But isn't that nice to do?
Yeah.
Did you get away anywhere?
Well, my daughter is over in Coventry, so she's lovely. Over in college there, so I went over to get hurt. Settled in, and I got to see the Killers in Belfast a couple of weeks ago as well.
What were they like?
Excellent.
Still able to do it?
Yes, and Johnny Marr, the guitarist with the Smiths, was playing support. And my first concert was the Smiths concert back in 1984. And 39 years later, I was back watching him. So I was back, I was a teenager for about 90 minutes.
That's
here,
lovely.
A few weeks
and
ago.
Is it the Killers that get drummers out of the crowd?
It wasn't on that occasion.
I think it was
a real mixture because like Brandon Flowers and the Killers have bring great energy, where Johnny Marr was a wee bit more laid back and less active maybe on the stage, but both equally entertaining and a really, really good night.
I was watching back at some of old footage from Glastonbury when I think it was Mr. Brightside had just been released.
Yeah.
But you could see by the way they were performing it and the way the audience were reacting, it hadn't become the jumping around anthem that it did generally become, if you know what I mean. It was kind of funny because I was like, well, this is all really low key.
But
obviously it grew into something.
Yeah,
it grew into something completely different.
They bring a real high tempo energy to their performance. So it was good night.
Nice. That's a cool one. I didn't even know they were playing in Belfast. Brilliant stuff. All right, let's talk about some business news now. In a workshop on LinkedIn, it's one of the most popular social media platforms, but one I don't go near because they look for money off you to see who's been looking at your profile. And I'm like, stuff you. Yeah. It's my profile. But anyway, it's hugely popular. They're not going to be too worried about what I say.
No. The collab at the ATU's Donegal campus on Letterkenny Sport Road is the venue for tomorrow's LinkedIn workshop that will be delivered by Dennis Finnegan from Growfuse. So those who attend will learn how to effectively market themselves and their business using LinkedIn. Two-hour event starts at 9 a.m. It's free to Letterkenny Chamber members and collab clients. And there's also a €10 fee for non-members. To secure a place, Greg, email marie@letterkennychamber.com or check out Letterkenny Chamber's social media platforms.
If I'm not mistaken, Letterkenny Chamber membership has actually surpassed 300 now. We might talk about that a little later on in the week. Okay, the energy support scheme?
Yeah, the Donegal Local Enterprise are just giving a heads up to businesses that the government has launched a new energy support scheme for businesses that were impacted by significant increases in the cost of kerosene during 2022. So the Business Users Support Scheme for Kerosene, also known as BUSK, B-U-S-S-K, will compensate eligible businesses for 50% of the increased cost of kerosene purchased for heating their business premises. And that's during the period from March the 1st to December 31st last year. And that's comparing the average retail price for the same period in 2021. So it's a worthwhile exercise for businesses to look at, Greg. There will be a guaranteed minimum payment of €500. Which is significant.
Well, and kerosene is more generally known as home heating oil, isn't it? Yeah, okay. I always get confused at the pump. Right, Donegal ATB's environmental sustainability courses. What are these about?
Yeah, for local businesses concerned about the climate crisis and who'd like to learn about contributing a more sustainable future, Donegal ETB's Further Education and Training Service has a number of part-time courses starting this autumn that can expand businesses' knowledge base in this area. So for more information on the upcoming courses, Greg, people can email enterpriseengagement@donegaletb.ie, and there are two different courses around various parts of the county.
Now, Boyle Construction are busy boys and they're up for a major award.
Yes, Boyle Construction has been shortlisted for the highly prestigious ICI Award for 2023 in the category of Contractor Health Stroke Education Project of the Year. The project involved the refurbishment of the existing Shield building in Ballyshannon and the construction of two new three-storey wings. The award winners will be announced at a function in the Mansion House in Dublin on November the 2nd. And just for record purposes, Boyle Construction is based in Letterkenny and was set up by Donal and Eugene in 1984.
Now, we heard earlier on from Ireland West, a.k.a. Knock Airport. Yes. They've experienced record numbers for 2023 and really excited for 2024. And it's good news too, isn't it, for Donegal Airport?
Yeah. Summer good news story, Greg. Last month saw the largest number of passengers flying with Aer Lingus Regional between Dublin and Donegal Airport since the inception of the route in 1996. The route operated by Emerald Airlines experienced a 13% increase in passengers compared to the previous year. And according to Emerald Airlines, the growth is being driven by strong tourist demand, particularly from those travelling from North America.
And not unlike Knock Airport, you can begin your flight, load your luggage on in Donegal Airport and pick it up in your international destination, the same as you can at a Knock, which is great. Okie doke, let's go on to what's on this week's podcast, which is available right now, and we'll let you know where shortly. Who's your guest?
Yeah, my guest this week, Greg, is the former Managing Director of Fruit of the Loom and former Chair of the International Fund for Ireland, Willie McCarter, who now works as an independent advisor. 4 days after graduating from Trinity College in Economics and Political Science in 1969, he began his master's degree at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Well, he came home in 1971 to work in the family's underwear-making business, W.P. McCarter, and the following year, he became managing director at the age of 25, following the death of his uncle, Willie. McCarter signed a deal with Fruit of the Loom in 1987, and it became a major employer in Donegal and Derry, as we know, during a 20-year period. At full capacity, Fruit of the Loom employed 3,000 people and produced 1 million t-shirts and 400,000 sweatshirts per week. In this clip, Willie recalls the contract McCarter secured with Adidas in the mid-70s.
There's a guy in Cork called Michael O'Connell who was the distributor for Adidas. And Michael kept on at us, look, you know, we'd like to get three-stripe T-shirts produced in Ireland. So we got yarn spun in Hong Kong and They brought the yarn in and we made these three-stripe T-shirts, took them over to Germany, and talk about the 1,000 dozen a week. We got an order written for those for 500,000 three-stripe T-shirts that set us out on the road to making serious sportswear for Adidas. And then we got into fleece, jogging suits and sweatshirts and all of that. And that led us into Levi sweatshirts. And we still had the fashion T-shirt business.
So was the deal with Adidas a major game changer for the progress and future of your company back then?
It was. It was. That was about 1976, and we were a major producer for Adidas for about 10 years. In fact, I think we probably produced about 15 million three-stripe T-shirts and, I don't know, a couple of million of jogging suits.
I wonder if he got any of the originals lying around the place still in their packaging. That would be worth a pretty penny, I think.
I was wondering that myself. Were I was you? Talking to them down in
front. Business people based deep down. Come here. All of your guests are fantastic, but that's a particularly nice one to guess, I suppose, given his experience, but also given how important he is to support. I mean, you mentioned Fruit of the Loom anywhere across the Northwest. Everyone knows precisely what you're talking about. And someone they know or they themselves work there.
3,000 workers at various plants in Buncrana, Milford, Dunlow, two in Derry. I think there was 3 actually in Buncrana at that stage. And one of the things Willie said, while it trained a lot of people, it actually trained him as well, and he learned a lot through the experience that lasted around about 20 years. But when you hear somebody talking about 15 million three-stripe T-shirts and a couple of million jogging suits, it gives some sort of indication before Fruit of the Loom, which was even bigger gain in terms of production, the scale. Just to point out, the WP McCarty was set up in 1932 by the previous generation, and they managed to take 6 people and set up in Buncrana. And when Willie came back from America in the early 70s, having graduated from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, his father actually wrote to him and asked him could he come back when he was finished up. And Willie's plan was to come back for a 6-month period after he returned to Ireland. And as he said himself, he's still here.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, the full interview with Willie McCarter is available for you to stream or download from our website, highlandradio.com. You'll see it in the top stories there, and it'll be in the featured stories too a little later on. Or I think it's also available for you on Spotify or iTunes. But lots of people like to just listen as a live show. When's that on, Kieran?
Yeah, well, he was on himself this morning. He was just double-checking when it was on Sunday. So it's Sunday evening, Greg, after the 6 o'clock news.
And if anyone would like to get in touch with you now that you are, I suppose, refreshed, re-energised, you know, ready for the next 100.
Yeah, just drop me an email, please. businessmatters@highlandradio.com.
Sounds like you didn't recognise that description.
Definitely thought you were talking about somebody else.
All right, great to have you back, Kieran.
Cheers,
thanks,
Greg.
Very much indeed. Our website, highlandradio.com, or after the 6 o'clock news on Sunday. Welcome back to the programme. How are you all keeping out there? I hope you're very well indeed. Well done, Karen. I had ME for 10 years, was as bad as yourself. No one understands, and I mean no one. Only for a specialist in ME in Galway, I'd probably still be bedbound. He was excellent. Cost me an arm and a leg financially, but well worth it. I finally got my life back. That comes in from Mary. And Mary, also very glad to hear that worked for you. Do you happen to drive from Letterkenny to Killybegs every day? Well, a listener who's starting at the Killybegs campus at ATU is looking for a lift on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesdays, and they're willing to share your fuel cost, your expenses. We have a number here, by the way, if that suits you. So it's someone going from Letterkenny to Killybegs, presumably back, Monday, Tuesdays and Wednesdays. They're studying at the Killybegs campus at ATU, and they'll provide a bit of company and to split those expenses for you. Or at least contribute to them. Okay, tonight at the Verbal Arts Centre in Derry, Sinn Féin's Commission on the Future of Ireland will host its 7th public meeting in Derry at 7:30 p.m. A panel discussion entitled Exploring Northern Protestant Identities in a Shared Future will take place, as I mentioned there, at the Verbal Arts Centre. Councillor Conor Heaney joins me on the programme now to discuss this. Hi, Conor.
Hi, Greg.
So how have these events gone so far?
They've all been extremely successful events, really well attended, excellent discussion. on a whole range of topics. We've held, as you say, we had six people's assemblies in various parts of Ireland, including Donegal, and a number of sectoral events, a youth event and a women's event. And this one is focusing on Northern Protestant culture and tradition in the future. So it should be a really good discussion tonight.
And in the audience, you know, are you going to be speaking about people that aren't there? I mean, obviously, I presume you're inviting everyone, but do you anticipate that many who are the subject of this conversation might actually turn up?
Well, both the chair and the panelists are all from that tradition. So they will be outlining from their perspective the importance of their culture, their views on various issues. So that'll be the focus. The audience will be mixed. I anticipate it will be largely nationalist, given that it's in the city of Derry. But that's a positive thing, because it's about learning from each other, hearing from each other, and getting an insight into the importance of the Northern Protestant cultures and traditions as we look to the future and as we are discussing what a new Ireland might look like.
Yeah, and a new Ireland, if it were united, would look like a country with almost an instant minority of Northern Protestants, you know, on a 32-county basis. So I suppose that would be a challenge to recognise who they are, their cultures, their identities, the celebration of those cultures and identities in a very different country as an island as a whole.
Well, absolutely, and that's the importance of this discussion and discussions beyond this, because this is only a beginning of this, certainly in the city, and there's been similar work happening in Belfast for quite some time. So it's a really important record. There already was an instant minority created in the south when the country was partitioned. How that was managed and handled is another debate, and whether that was done as well as it should have been done. So we're looking to learn from mistakes in the past and ensure that people are informed and have an opportunity to debate and tease all these issues out as soon as possible. As you know, it's been Sinn Féin's position that the Irish government should establish a citizens' assembly, an all-island citizens' assembly, that will be hosting discussions and debates like this. But in the interim, Sinn Féin are doing what we can. They host people's assemblies mm-hmm. right throughout. There'll be the rest of the autumn. There'll be another one now coming up in Waterford and in the Gaeltacht in Galway.
Mm. Now, Micheál Martin himself, from a Fianna Fáil perspective, would argue that he's doing quite a bit of work in this area. And then we heard from the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar earlier this week, or towards the end of last week, saying he believes there will be a united Ireland in his lifetime. It seems all the major parties, at least in the south, are all planning for the same inevitability, it seems.
Well, you know, saying that is fine, and but practical preparations need to get underway. So that, as people know, the process towards any referendum in the country begins with a citizens' assembly and with bringing the membership of that together and putting practical and detailed work, the whole range of matters that that people then can make a decision on.
Yeah.
So,
and it'll be an interesting. So, whenever that vote happens, it's going to be interesting, because it's not necessarily going to be about green or orange or what Catholics think or Protestants think. It's going to be an all-Ireland vote. You'll have to sell it to the people of Cork that they want to take on whatever they might have to take on. The people of Kerry probably, you know, don't have a great deal of affinity with Northern Ireland. We have a very diverse and getting ever so more diverse population on the island of Ireland. And we haven't really even started talking about healthcare, you know, postal systems, road networks, the massive amount of people in Northern Ireland employed by the government, for an example. You know, we haven't I mean, this is very worthwhile, of course, but we haven't really, I don't think, opened the can on the real conversations that will be happening across the entire island as soon as we sort of get note of an actual border poll stroke referendum taking place.
Yeah, absolutely. The issues are vast, and you know, they will be primarily focused on the economy, on education, on health, on all the issues that really matter to people. You know, but there, as you said yourself, there will be a sizable minority contained in a new Ireland, and that's why we need to have the discussions now as well, to see how all of that can be incorporated, managed, protected, and all that. But, you know, all the issues you listed are there, but it just makes the argument even stronger that we need a Citizens' Assembly to start focusing on all that, and properly managed through, you know, the Irish government.
All right.
Towards that, so.
Well, the Sinn Féin's New Ireland Commission event takes place, the Commission on the Future of Ireland, takes place in Derry tonight. It's entitled Exploring Northern Protestant Identities in a Shared Future. It's taking place at the Verbal Arts Centre. Panellists include activist Catherine Pollock, Nigel Gardner, Catherine Cook, Alison Wallace. Everyone, as you say, Councillor, is welcome to attend. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Greg.
All right, bye-bye. Councillor Conor Heaney there, 086 60 25,000. A quick mention, if you don't mind, of this next September. Pretty much a year to the day. Highland Radio's Hooli in Sulu takes place, hosted by David James, with a whole host of fantastic artists, Margot, John McNichol, Robert Mazzell, Hugo Duncan, and on it goes. You are being invited to attend. You have access to all shows. You've got accommodation, you've got dinner, you've got bed and breakfast, you've got nighttime entertainment, you've got daytime entertainment, or you can go and do whatever you want in the day. Anyway, we want you to go with us. The price is £8.17 per person sharing. It's access to all shows, airport transfers, dinner each evening with wine included, and no end of fun and entertainment and forming of friendships and so on and so forth. You have to book your own flights, but our team can help you with that. Go to countrymusictours.ie for more information. countrytours.ie. All right, okay. Now, that's where we have to leave it on the programme today. My thanks, very special thanks to Donna Marie Doherty, and also Niamh Shields, who worked very hard on the programme. We're back with you tomorrow morning from 9. Stay tuned. John Bresson's Around the Northwest after the news at 12.